The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I'm joined today by author and journalist Dominic Bliss, whose first book, Erbsdeen, The Triumph and Tragedy of Football's Forgotten Pioneer, the first title published by Blizzard Books, earned rave reviews and was recently included in Squawker's list of 50 football books to read before you die. Well, thank you very much for coming in to, for an episode of 1&1. We're talking about your work as well as your life as a football fan. You love Italian football, that sort of thing. You cover a lot of football that people perhaps don't know enough about. But also has its own sort of niche following. But I just want to start probably from the beginning. How did you first fall in love with football?
I remember Italia 90 vividly, and yet I was born in 84, so I would have been 5 years old at the time. I turned six a few months later, and I remember that tournament, I think, vividly. Whether or not I've kind of added that in postscript, I don't know, but I seem to remember the little snippets around it, you know, the font that came up on the screen and the typefaces, Nessun Dorma, yeah. Certain players that stuck out, Roger Mia, Valderrama. They aren't secondary sources, really, if you like. Those are things I remember. And as a small child, the things that you remember are really kind of ephemeral. I don't remember a 90-minute match and I don't remember how the games panned out, but I remember certain things that stood out and stayed with me, and I really fell for it. I remember getting some stickers and putting them on the wardrobe of the Yugoslavia team, and so I supported Yugoslavia for
Italian.
So you
already decided you were going to go down this kind of route? This
immediately sort of niche, yeah, yeah. As a five-year-old.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I feel like I'm on the couch here.
Yeah, just sort of happened.
What does it stand out? What does it be different? No, I really don't know. I think it was partly that, though. Genuinely, I think everyone was interested in one thing, and even as a small kid, I remember taking an immediate interest in Nottingham Forest, for example, when the cup final was on in 91, and they were playing Tottenham, and the story was Gazza and Tottenham, and and I thought, oh, Forest are interesting. And from those early days, I had a real interest in Nottingham Forest, even though they're not the team I support.
So were you not from Nottingham area or anything like that? Or?
No, I'm from Surrey, which is, I'm a Chelsea supporter. So that's what they're one of the local teams. There's no league clubs in Surrey. So you kind of go for the South or West London teams.
But the first love was Nottingham Forest.
But the first team that captured my attention as a sort of 5-6-year-old was Nottingham Forest for a couple of years. I was interested in them. And then I got to the age where I wanted to go to football, and my mum was an avid Chelsea supporter. She wanted to go to Stamford Bridge more regularly. She wanted to take me along. We went to a few games. I really liked it. My dad was a Fulham supporter and had been for many years. He took me to a few games. I liked it less. And so I was more excited by Stamford Bridge. I loved going to Fulham. I loved going to all football. Tried out Palace for a bit as well, but the team that I really took to, the place I felt at home was Chelsea. It was Stamford Bridge. It was just an exciting team that always fell short. It was just after they had signed Hullett and these Mark Hughes and these kind of nearly couple of years before the 97 Cup final. And after the 97 Cup final, we decided to get season tickets, and I've had one ever since. So I fell in love with football first, and then picked my team, which I remember my dad saying was a conscious thing. He could have had me down as a Fulham supporter from an early age, and he said he didn't like that parents who did that. He didn't like that idea. He liked the idea of his sons choosing their team. So my brother ended up choosing Fulham. But again, kind of by a strange route of liking Palace for a while and things like that. So it was, I'm talking about a really young age. I didn't change teams as a...
yeah. You're allowed to at that point.
I don't know if there's anything niche about that, but there was certainly was about that interest in other international teams that I had from an early age. I've always backed England and wanted England to win, but I've never been particularly squeamish about saying I quite like Holland or I'd like Yugoslavia to win. You know, I liked certain teams and the way they play and their footballing cultures.
So you've written Erbstein and also cover sort of articles that are about figures who are kind of more forgotten. You recently did a piece on Guillermo Amor, who played for Barcelona, I believe.
That's right, in the dream team.
Yeah. So who was he and what's the story behind it? Why is he an interesting figure?
Well, he's I suppose a lesser known member of that Johan Cruyff Barcelona dream team, but he was very much a creative influence on them, a sort of technical midfielder. He played in an attacking midfield role. He wore all the shirts you can wear in the attacking area just before squad number. So he'd be a 7, an 8, a 9 at times, a 10. But really, he was an attacking midfielder, and he played with Romario, Stoichkov, all these great players, and Guardiola behind him. And what interested me was when I read that Guardiola had, I suppose, idolised is a strong word. He looked up to him. He saw him as an impressive older kid. You know, he was 3 years older than him. And when he was at La Masia, Guardiola, as a sort of 13-year-old, I think he saw this 16, 17-year-old on the fringes of the B team. And he was the kind of impressive one standing there in technical sessions with his hands on his hips, asking questions of the coach, trying to get to the bottom of things. And I think Guardiola was clearly impressed by this. He's spoken about it, he's written about it. And I like the idea of someone that can have that, cut that figure from an early age. And the more I looked into him, I just see who this guy is. I remembered him taking a penalty in Euro 96 against England where he stalled in his run-up. And it caused a bit of consternation with Ron Atkinson in the commentary box. Oh, that check step, I don't like that. It's now normal. Balotelli does it all the time. And I think I'm going to write an article exploring that that concept of the check step penalty and, you know, how we don't seem to like it in this country. We've got it's like wearing short sleeves in goal or something. It's a little bit continental.
Yeah. It's still alien, isn't
it?
We're not sure about that, you know.
And I'm going to write about, and I'm one of those people, so I'm going to write a sort of exploration into my own prejudice against the check step penalty, I think, next. Amor has kind of inspired me to write that. But I saw that he signed for Livingston at the end of his career, and I just thought that was interesting. So I looked into it, and I pulled the thread, and I spoke to the manager who signed him, and it turns out that they signed a string of Spanish players around that time, and they'd signed them on the back of Adrianians going under in the lower leagues. Adrianians had signed a batch of 8 to 10 Spanish players. And all these different tangents kind of opened up. So I've said I don't really know what it is, this article, but it's fascinating. It's an exploration of how a player at the fulcrum of one of the best club teams in the 90s can end up playing in midfield for Livingston. It's a story about the rise of a Scottish team temporarily and the ending of a great player's career, albeit not a famous name, but his achievements kind of far outweigh his fame.
And you can check that piece out on The Set Pieces, right?
That's it, thesetpieces.com.
And so, Erbstein as well, you kind of mentioned on the inspiration for that piece, how it came along, but again, you're sort of unravelling this thread of a man who you in your introduction to the book mentioned that his story kind of left on the shelf.
Yeah.
Why do you think he was so forgotten? I mean, compared to, say, the Milan of the 90s or bigger Italian teams. This was a Torino side that won 5 consecutive Serie A titles. So
that's right.
Do you think?
They were pre-TV, which is a big deal. Mm. Pre-European competition, which is another big deal. So those key markers, you know, people say, I saw Milan on the telly. There was one European game a season, and it was the European Cup final. Or they might say, you know, they might say about the Real Madrid team. Sorry, not Milan. Or you might look back to the '90s and think, occasionally you saw some Italian football or the European Cup, and you saw Milan and were impressed by them. I don't think anyone, first of all, is alive who would have watched the Grande Torino in this country anyway. Even if you go back 20 odd years, it wasn't a time where people took an interest in foreign football. There was nothing on the telly, and there wouldn't have been any records of them winning the UEFA Cup or the European Cup because it hadn't been invented yet. So those yardsticks weren't there. But people know the Grande Torino. People don't know Erbstein. So that's another question. I think maybe this all-Italian team, local boys, heroes, or local heroes, I should say, because they weren't all local boys, that gave people hope in Italy after the war when I think collective self-esteem or morale, I suppose, more importantly, was at a low. You had one or two things lifting the country, and the Grande Torino was one of them. And their players were also the national team, effectively. At one point, 10 of them started the game for Italy, but all 11 of them played regularly for Italy. So there was this idea that they were the ragazzi, the boys, the local heroes, and the manager was a kind of a marginal figure, and he wasn't Italian. So I think perhaps that was one of the reasons why he was lesser known. But I think all the guys that weren't in the team are not that well known.
So he was Hungarian.
Hungarian, yes, yeah.
And Jewish as well, and that.
Yes, of Jewish origin. We don't know how. I mean, he was Jewish, but we don't know if he didn't identify throughout his adult life. Certainly, his daughter Susanna told me she didn't remember him ever going to a synagogue or identifying as Jewish, and she identifies as Italian as a Catholic. But yes, certainly he was persecuted because he was Jewish.
Before the start of the war, he was in charge of Torino.
He took over Torino in 1938, midway through the 38-39 season, he had to flee with his family because the Manifesto of Race in Italy demanded that foreign Jews leave the country. So he was out of a job and it wasn't safe to live there anymore. They had to go. So halfway through his first season as in charge of Torino, he had this big rebuilding job of a club in front of him that him and the president were very excited about. Ferruccio Nova, the president, was a young guy, a businessman who wanted to structure the club, build this new modern football club in the mould of an Arsenal in England at the time. And he wanted a manager who could help do that, who could build an 11 from without buying just the best players, who could build an 11 that could dominate Italian football and then make it a sustainable model, but also a team that had a scouting set up, that had sports science involved, you know, nutrition, all of these things, up-to-date training methods. They wanted a modern football club.
He was very ahead of his time.
Yeah, they saw Erbstein as a guy who was doing these things with his previous clubs, because he'd basically overachieved with Minnows before that. And it would be a bit like Eddie Howe being taken on by Arsenal and winning the league five times. You know, it's that kind of a story. He's taken a team, he played in red and black stripes up to the top flight and battered above their average there. I think they finished seventh in Lucchese, sorry, I'm talking about here. And he got the job off the back of taking Lucchese in 5 years from Serie C1, which is the effectively like the third division north or whatever in England, into Serie A, and they finished seventh above Inter and Roma that year. And Torino said, we'll have a bit of that. But there was a year between that where he began to see the way the wind was blowing in Italy. And Lucca was very much a fascist town. There were key members of the government, of the fascist state, who lived and worked in Lucca.
So what part of Italy is that?
It's in Tuscany, very near Florence. It's a beautiful medieval fortress town. And the ramparts, the city walls, are completely intact if you go there still. They used to, from the medieval times, they used to train on the top of them. So they would be overlooking the city, doing these aerobic exercises in the first thing in the morning.
Surreal images, though.
Yeah, but he was a motivator. So it'd be like, get the air in your lungs, boys. You know, look at this. This is motivating. And when they came back from away games that they'd won, by all accounts, the big games, they would be crowds waiting for their coach to get back. And then they'd be chaired shoulder high around the city walls. And they'd all celebrate in the Anteteatro Piazza, which is a beautiful ovular piazza in the centre. It's a stunning town. It's the town of Puccini as well, so it's kind of like the home of opera in some sense. A really cultured place in Tuscany. But unfortunately, it was one of the places that took to fascism, or certainly where important figureheads of the fascist setup lived and worked, and it wasn't safe for Erbstein to remain, so he quietly exited and he pitched up again at Torino, but he couldn't stay there for long either. Mm. It was only after the war that he came back to Turin. Much of his ideas had been put in place in that time, and they'd already won two titles. He returned, and in the time he'd gone, he had been in contact with them by telephone, by telegram, yeah. by letter, even incognito trips. You know, he'd been very much involved, but from a distance. Kind of like one manager talked about the presence of Erbstein being felt even when he wasn't there, and no manager could take that job for long because they felt that they were only keeping the seat warm, really.
So what do you think is, I mean, you've been to Italy a lot to do a lot of research.
And, that's right, yeah.
And cover a lot of games. You went to Torino matches, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. I went to Turin a couple of times early on and went to a match against Gallipoli, yeah. funny enough, in Serie B. But straight away I got the impression that Torino's a club that's not forgotten, the Grande Torino. They don't forget that team. They in fact, they're at the forefront of almost everything they do. They come up all the time. It was almost like they made a promise not to let that team's memory, not to let the legacy go away, and everyone takes that very seriously.
Mm. So, I mean, you say you're a Chelsea fan, but what do you think the best game you've seen live is?
Best game you've seen live? Well, I was at the game Chelsea-Barcelona in 2004-05 season when Chelsea turned the game around with three early goals at the Bridge in the second leg and won 4-2. Ronaldinho scored that remarkable goal past Carvalho. That was incredible. I've not seen people celebrate like that. I think the only other time I saw people celebrate like that was Chelsea-Barcelona in 99-2000 when Chelsea took a three-goal lead against Barcelona in their first season in the Champions League in the quarter-final. And I saw just bodies tumbling over seats because they were celebrating so much they'd all just lost their balance and gone. And I couldn't believe it. But Luis Figo scored a late away goal, and the second leg, Barcelona turned it round on that occasion. So those were kind of, I think the celebrations were bigger at those games. Mm. They felt bigger because it was more of a surprise that Chelsea were competing at that level at that time. It was, oh my God, we're really here. This is our level now. Less the tension of we should do it and more attention of are we really doing this? So I remember those games. What else? One of the key games I remember being at was a playoff final between Crystal Palace and Sheffield United in the mid-90s. And it wasn't a good game, but it was just this, because it was a playoff final, this unbearable tension. And David Hopkins scored right at the end to score the winner right at the end. And it was absolutely... The Palace fans went absolutely berserk. It was huge. I just remember that game being a playoff finals. You don't realise unless you're there. I suppose you get the Sky Sports building it up because of the money involved, but you don't realise when you're there. Just the fans are living on their wits at playoff finals. Mm. It's living on their nerves. Sorry, at playoff finals, it's absolutely devastating to see the people, how nervous people are before playoff finals. So that felt really big.
Yeah.
Been to cup finals and never felt that. Playoff finals just feel so final. It feels so, it's all or nothing.
I think going back to sort of Italy, I think Italian football gets kind of a bad rap for the few attendance. Certainly recent seasons.
It does affect the atmosphere
as well. How is that seen by people there?
I think there's a sort of, I don't know the politics of it, and I don't want to wade in and say anything, but I think there's some people who feel that ultra culture is a wonderful thing and we should protect it. But
beyond that.
And then there are other people who think that it's a negative effect. You know, people don't want to go with their families. And there's two ways of looking at it. And I can see both angles on that one. So I find it difficult. Beyond that...
If you have the ultras there... They're always there. They're going to provide that presence, that noise. But you look around them, the rest of the stands are empty.
But I think partly because they're there, possibly. You know, some people don't want to take the family there, and Certainly that's been said. But also there's talk of how the authorities treat football fans in Italy. Again, you're better off talking to someone who regularly attends games there, but there was talk of ID cards in this country once, and it was people were in uproar about it. Mm. But in Italy, they introduced that. You have to have your identity on your ticket. It's almost like they're putting a barrier up to stop people going. And I've been to games, and I've always felt like you feel like you're edgy just for going to a football match, and you're made to feel that way by the authorities.
So when you went to games, did you have to provide your own ID card?
In Bari, my wife was asked for her passport to prove it was her. I wasn't, so it was obviously a random check. But there was just this kind of a complete lack of stewarding inside the stadium, where everyone could do practically what they wanted. But on the outside, this kind of lockdown. So once you're in, you're in, but on the outside, you're made to feel like you'll be lucky to get in almost. And that was the impression I got. Mm. But that's as an outsider going there once or twice a season. It really does depend on the game as well. I mean, I went to the new Juventus stadium to see them play Genoa in the middle of the season a couple of years ago. It was freezing cold. And that just felt like going to a ground in England. It was just easy access. All the facilities were the same. Just felt like any other new stadium. So I think it does depend very much on how that club decides to go about it.
So if you went to Torino now, what are the sort of the memories? How do they memorialise Herbstein in the stadium, in the kind of match day experience? Do you kind of feel the ghost of him, or is it
Herbstein? No, not really. And the Grande Torino,
yeah.
Herbstein, for some reason, for a long time, wasn't given the same billing as the players.
There's no statue or anything like that.
No, nothing like that. But in recent years, there seems to have been a small change in that direction. Although the club didn't want to stock my book.
Mm. Was that surprising?
It's in English, maybe. Maybe that's the reason. Yeah. But all the stalls and things like that around Turin and around the stadium will have little key rings and all sorts of merchandise with Grande Torino squad photos. Mm. And you'll see Herbstein on the side of that. And the other thing is the Museo del Grande Torino, which is a museum. It's for Torino as a club, but it's 80%, I would say, Grande Torino. Mm. And they have all the memorabilia from the old Stadio Philadelphia, which they're rebuilding now as a sort of training ground and youth stadium, exactly where it was. They have all these different things. They've got parts of the aeroplane in there, the old tribuna, the wooden seats that they used to sit on. They got the bugle that this famous supporter, who was a railway porter, used to blow to when the team apparently were a bit lackluster. That was his way of saying roll your sleeves up. Herbstein had an exhibition there, completely unrelated to my book, because it was about a year before the book came out, and I remember being kind of lifted by that. I thought, okay, they're taking him into their bosom a bit again. But he did seem to. There didn't seem to be much trace of him when I was looking for him. Old books would mention him, but not much else. Yeah.
And you did a lot of research for this. You had to, considering how little had kind of been left for him. And
I spent a lot of time in the La Stampa archive, which is all online. And there would be hours I could be going to bed at 5 a.m. with red eyes, because I'd just been clicking through every article with his name on it and translating it to look for any kind of hint of. And I found so much, so many different trails that had been completely forgotten.
What was the strangest experience you had?
One of the things that really surprised me was that he had just after he returned from Hungary to Italy, which would have been in the 46-47 season. He went back to Hungary shortly before the Iron Curtain kind of came down, and before relationships between East and West were completely frozen out. He went back, and I think he had affairs to look after and, you know, business matters. But he also needed to help his family to get out and come to Italy with him, because he'd come back on his own initially, although his eldest daughter was married to an Italian, so she was back as well. He had, while he was there, he decided to bring back one of the better footballers with him. So he just returned to Italy with this player he'd scouted. he ended up playing for Lucchese rather than Torino, because he wasn't quite at the Standard.
Why do you think he brought him back? Was there a
He had contacts. He knew that no one else was signing players from Eastern Europe at the time. He was able to say, someone say to him, oh, we've got this really good player at Slovan Bratislava or, you know, MTK Budapest or whoever it was. And do you want to come and see him? He'd love to play in Italy. And Erbstein was able to make that happen. Laszlo Kubala, the Barcelona legend, he was kind of not smuggled out of Italy, but I suppose they managed to get him out of Hungary. So they managed to get him through Erbstein. He had to wrangle and pull strings here and there. And there was a lot of political to-ing and fro-ing to kind of extricate him from the club he was at. I think he was at Slovan Bratislava, actually, in Slovakia. So he would have been playing in Czechoslovakia, but he was Hungarian / Slovakian, I think, Kubala. Someone would probably be able to look this up. But he had to do all sorts of political wrangling because he had connections, Erbstein, upstairs, in order to get Kubala out. And he brought him to Italy. And there's a story that he was due to be on the flight that the team died on as a kind of precursor to maybe signing for the club the next season. And he was without a club at that point. But he didn't go because of an illness in the family, and he ended up becoming one of Barcelona's greatest ever players. So there's another subplot here, and that was one of the strangest stories that among these Eastern European players that he'd scouted on these little incognito trips to and fro, he'd spotted or been able to get Laszlo Kubala out.
And just to sort of think about the mighty Magyars who came after him, was there any connection between Erbstein and them? Or
I think there's a connection in terms of the way they played, maybe. Yeah. He actually, Puskas played against the Grande Torino as Italy. So Italy played Hungary in 1947 with 10 of the Grande Torino starting. And the Hungary manager was... the Hungary team was made up 10 players from a club called Vasas, whose manager was Béla Gutmann.
Are they still existing? Or?
I don't know if Vasas still exists. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't have another name.
It's one to find out.
Yeah. But Béla Gutmann, of course, went on to win the European Cup and the Copa Libertadores. I don't know if anyone else has ever done that. He managed Benfica and AC Milan. He was in the same... labour camp as Erbstein during the Budapest Holocaust. They escaped together shortly before the members of that work group were taken to Auschwitz. They escaped together in a group of five or six, managed to kind of plot their escape. And you can imagine two of these great tacticians working together to plot an escape from a labour camp. Later on, they are managing the two top teams in Italy and Hungary. And 10 of each of them are playing against each other in an international match. One of whom was Puskas, a teenage Puskas. And he said to Sandro Mazzola, who was the son of the Grande Torino captain Valentino Mazzola, when he played Italy in the end of his career, in the early 70s, you're worthy of your father's shirt. It was like a tear-jerking moment.
Wow. Yeah.
This incredible moment where Puskas played against possibly one of the greatest father-son, possibly the greatest father-son combination maybe in football, Valentino Mazzola, captain of the Grande Torino, number 10, their sort of Steven Gerrard. You know, he made things happen when they looked like they weren't going to. He dominated that team completely. He was the man. His son, Sandro Mazzola, number 10 for the La Grande Inter, their greatest team. He was their greatest player. And father and son both played against Puskas at either end of his career. So all these great stories that come out of it. So I think Puskas would have been influenced by Erbstein, in that Erbstein was one of several Hungarian coaches of that era who was starting to play the the kind of precursor of total football. Put the ball in space, run onto it, don't play to the player's feet. He said that led to inertia. If you play the ball to a player's feet, you still play it in front of him, you're more fluid. You can overlap, you can work better like that. It sounds obvious now, play the ball in front of someone, you're taught that from an early age now, but he kind of was one of this group of Hungarian managers who were the first to say it. And they called it a new theory of space in the press in Lucca when he did it with Lucchese. Erbstein's new theory of space is, you know, revelatory.
Whipping up a storm.
Yeah, he was total football in the 30s.
Well, I think we're now going to hear a passage, if you want to...
Absolutely, yeah.
Introduce it. What's the...
So this is a story... a passage of probably describes best how Erbstein was a pioneer, which is what a lot of people ask. What did he do that was different? So I think it gives you an idea of different things that he was doing to help the team to be streets ahead, I suppose, of everyone else. But you also get an idea of his character as well, the strength of his character.
Let's hear it.
There was a lot more to the Grande Torino's success than their advanced playing system. Much of this was down to the attention to detail that Egri Erbstein insisted upon in every department of the team's preparation. When he described himself as, at the same time, something more and something less than manager of Torino, he was not just offering acute philosophical self-assessments. In fact, far from being the paradox it appears, his statement was a very insightful way to describe his role at the club. Egri Erbstein filled a space that was more like that of an engineer. He drew up plans, discussed new ideas, and shaped the team to be as effective as possible, as though he were fine-tuning a racing car. If he missed a training session or a game, it was because he was travelling to watch an upcoming opponent or a potential signing for his squad, while he also began to build connections with smaller clubs who recommended their most promising players to him in return for tactical and scouting information. In this regard, he was anticipating the days of feeder clubs, as Torino looked for every small advantage they could gain over the wealthier clubs, such as Juventus and Inter, who were desperate to catch them up and usurp them as the nation's footballing figureheads. This Torino side was a group of exceptionally talented players who had been handpicked to fill their roles within the Sistema. But Egri Erbstein's strategic nous was the icing on the cake. He had friends all over the country who would scout his upcoming opponents, while he would often fly to see them play himself so that he could be able to arm his players with all the information they needed to exploit their weaknesses. That level of attention to detail was far from common in the late 40s. The former Inter player Roberto Lerici recalled how Egri Erbstein had urged Giuseppe Glazar to burst forward from his usual deep midfield position into the Inter penalty area almost immediately after kickoff. As he arrived in the box, having left his unsuspecting marker for dead, he was picked out with a pinpoint long ball, and he got the first shot of the game away within seconds of the first whistle. "I'm sure it was no coincidence in that the move was designed and pre-planned," Lerici recalled. "Grezar was actually my direct opponent, and being very young and not very quick, I think I was the weak point in that Inter team, the Achilles heel. And Erbstein certainly knew it." Erbstein also delved into matters beyond the tactical. On one occasion, he arrived at the training ground keen to discuss the impact of nutrition on his players' fitness. He presented statistical data that showed that the physical condition of players in the south was better than that of their northern counterparts at certain times during the season, due to the nutritional value of local foodstuffs. After this unexpected talk from the Tecnico, the club began to import seasonal fruits and vegetables from the south and distributed vitamin supplements to the players as part of their pre-game preparations. Egri Erbstein was moving Torino into a brave new world as Italian football entered the age of sports science. In the immediate post-war years, the Italian people were low on collective self-esteem, and they wanted for heroes, for good examples and for things that functioned. Thanks largely to US investment, the industries of Turin began to fire again. The legs of cyclists Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartali fueled the pride of the nation's sports fans, and the Grande Torino, driven forward by their unwavering midfield quadrilateral, gave the people of Turin and the rest of the country another success story to rally around. During the 1946-47 season, however, the team were just beginning to realise their status as national icons, and there were still one or two occasions when opposition supporters tried to put them off their stride, particularly when the game turned nasty. Egri Erbstein may have sent his players into action with the words, "play fair, smile and pass the ball," but he was well aware that his men relished the matches that became physical battles. The more aggressive their opponents were in dealing with them, the more determined Mazzola and his teammates became, and in this regard they resembled the sides that Egri Erbstein had imbued with fighting spirit early in his managerial career. When Livorno tried to turn the screw during a game in May 1947, at which point Torino were a runaway train at the top of Serie A, Egri Erbstein's players gritted their teeth and battled their way to a 2-0 away victory, responding in kind to the rough treatment being doled out by their hosts. In the second half, Ernesto paced along the touchline, and the tough Tuscan supporters who were clinging to the fence surrounded the pitch began to heckle him. They were furious at the way their team had been physically overpowered, and they lined up to air their misgivings by shouting abuse at Egri Erbstein, who continued to puff casually on his cigarette, refusing to take his eyes off the pitch. Finally, one local fan, his voice contorted with rage, screamed, "Thugs! You and your whole team!" Egri Erbstein turned around with a broad grin spreading across his face. "And you," he said, "are all gentlemen."
Now, Erbstein, inspirational character, but I'd like to know, who are the most inspirational people you've met, you've come across in football?
I would say Didier Drogba, because he's a man who used his status for good in his country in a, when they needed it the most. I think what he did in Ivory Coast, I wrote, I did a big interview for him, a cover feature for Sport magazine a few years ago, ahead of the African Nations Cup, and he said that sometimes it took his breath away. It was almost frightening how the team were surrounded by love when they went back to the Ivory Coast, to the point where people didn't give them any space, and they were crammed in, and
too much.
It was almost too much. But he learned to realize that was the ultimate compliment. That were hero, like actual heroes, and the fact that during a civil war, the team, I think they made an agreement to play in rebel territory in order to try and bring peace, to try and bring about a ceasefire, and it worked. And Drogba was one of the figureheads of that movement. And to think that a footballer would spot those opportunities rather than shirk them, I think, is inspirational. And you could see him on the pitch, that he's that kind of figure anyway. You could see in the stories of him in the dressing room after Chelsea won the Champions League in Munich, standing on the treatment table and just G-ing everyone up and giving this emotional talk about how this was his last game for the club. As it turned out, he returned. But Frank Lampard's spoken about it as being like a hair-raising moment. I think Didier Drogba has the power to make you feel good about yourself just by sort of complimenting you or whatever. And as an interviewer, you have to kind of rein in, and you know, you've got to be impartial. But looking back, I think he was one of the most inspirational people I've interviewed, certainly. Mm. So I'd say Didier Drogba. Who else? Viali, Gianluca Viali. Because I felt he was one of these people who I was in my teenage years, I really looked up to as a manager, because I felt it must have been so difficult to go from being a teammate to being the manager to suddenly have to change the way you are with friends to tell them you're not in the team or you're not doing this well enough. Anyone who's been in a workplace where a friend's been promoted above them or vice versa will imagine that on the level of footballers with their egos and the places in the team. And so when I met Viali and interviewed him, I felt like he would possibly shy away from talking about that. He didn't. He wanted to talk about all the things that were difficult, and he did so with a really philosophical mindset. I think he's the best pundit on TV, actually. I genuinely think that there's none better. So in a dream punditry studio, I would have Viali there.
And alongside him?
Alongside him, Pat Nevin, who just gives the greatest interviews. His stories are brilliant. He's not like that after dinner circuit style interviewee where you know he's practiced this story a million times. Sometimes he's reaching for this story. Oh, I seem to remember jumping over the fence to get into Morrissey's house once or whatever. And you're just like, where's this come from?
Brilliant anecdotes.
He's just got these anecdotes. They're fantastic. But he's also a great pundit. He sees things, the tactical eyes he has for a game. And I realise it's got a bit of a Chelsea bent to it, this studio. Yeah. So maybe
are you going to finish it off with?
I need to switch things about a bit. You know what? I really like Jamie Carragher. I didn't want to go all Sky Sports, but Jamie Carragher is brilliant at what he does. And recently helped me with a feature I was writing, so maybe I've got a soft spot for him. Mm. About the former head coach at Lillishall, Keith Blunt, who coached Carragher, and he was very keen to talk about
from a youngster,
the influence. So he was keen to talk about the influence he had in his career, and so was Jody Morris in the same class. So, but whenever Carragher talks about anything, he brings this real you see the value of experience. There's always this argument of, oh, do you need to have played the game?
Yeah.
Sometimes you think, well, this guy's played the game, I'm not getting anything from him. So, you know, there's no value there. But Carragher, you get the value of experience, I think.
And finally, three other books, football books, that we have to read?
Only a Game.
Yeah.
Which is Eamon Dunphy's book. It's a diary of a season by a player. And they had agreed before the season that the publisher had agreed that it would be a journalist, a supporter, a journalist who covered the team, a supporter of the team, and a player from the team. It was Millwall. And Eamon Dunphy was the player. About 3 or 4 months into the season, he was let go. So you've got this four-month diary. They didn't do the other aspects of it. They just, there's a four-month diary of a player's time at a football club unravelling. Like, no holds barred. You know what Eamon Dunphy's like as a pundit. Anyone who's seen the clips of him on Irish TV, he was like, he was just completely open about it. And there's the respect for certain figures, complete lack of respect for others. But he just tells it how he felt at the time, all the histrionics.
Could you compare him to a player today? Do you think there's a similar...
Joey Barton, maybe?
Mm.
Joey Barton, similar, I think. But it would be like if you had Joey Barton talking about his time at Rangers in the moment. So each night he was sitting down and writing what had happened that
dictating
day,
it, like
how he felt at that moment. He was left out of the team one day, and he talked about being in the players' lounge after the game, trying to kind of put a brave face on it because they'd won, but he was furious he wasn't in the team. Eamon Dunphy, this isn't. I think it's just one of the best books by a footballer because it's not an autobiography spanning everything. He brings into it his ideas on how the media and players get on, or how he remembered being let go by Matt Busby as a youth player at Man United, and he tells that story, that anecdote. But it's as part of a diary entry that day because he felt, having come out of a talk with the Millwall manager, he looked back on how Matt Busby had done it. And he talked about going in with these demands and coming out having, you know, all the fire taken out of his belly and still not got that pay rise, still not got that place in the team. And yet he thought, yeah, Matt Busby's right. And somehow he turned him around. And he was talking about the wisdom and the I suppose, the man management skills of Busby. That was just one anecdote. And I just think that I've never been more gripped by a football book. I read it in its entirety on the plane journey out to a holiday, and I just thought it was brilliant. I have to read it again, I think. So yeah, Only a Game by Eamon Dunphy. The Football Man by Arthur Hopcraft, which was written, I think, in the late 60s, and was kind of a homage to it. It was written in the last 10 years by Simon Cooper, called The Football Men.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes completely the same structure because it's meant to be a modern take on it. So Arthur Hopcraft's version, it was an attempt to look at, again, a bit like the original plan for Dunphy's book, the fans, the people who run clubs, referees, players, journalists, all of their lives, by a series of interviews and his own experience. And he's just such an evocative writer when he's describing the chants in crowds and he's describing the way that players appear, talking about Stanley Matthews as, I think he describes him, how old he looks, you know.
Yeah.
Talking about mining communities, things like this. And you get a real, you feel like you're getting a portrait of someone from Arthur Hopcraft's words. I really enjoyed reading about early chapter about George Best in his kind of Beatlemania era, and he was still living in digs. It's incredible. You see, he wasn't living in a mansion at that time. And all sorts of stories about players who had to retire because of injuries and had gone broke and depression, you know, an early book to look at that issue. So I think because of the way it's written and because of the amount of subjects it tackles, it's the most all-encompassing football book I've read, albeit it's dated. But I would encourage anyone to read it, The Football Man by Arthur Hopcraft.
Or the Cooper Update as well.
And the Cooper Update is good as well.
Yeah.
It's more of a collection of interviews and musings on those interviews, whereas Arthur Hopcraft feels like more of a complete work. So I would recommend that one higher, although I think Simon Cooper is one of the best football writers. I should add that.
Your third and final one.
Third and final one. Well, I don't want to bore everyone with this, but 31-0 by James Montague, which you talked about last week.
We may have discussed this on the previous episode of 101,
I considered leaving it out for that reason, and then I thought, but that would be not true to myself. Yeah. It is one of my three favourite football books. And
why is that?
Because dealing with the minnow sounds like a boring subject, and I was dubious going into it. I thought, I don't care.
Yeah. Because you're a Chelsea fan, or...?
No. I just thought, what what could be of interest about San Marino?
Yeah,
I don't know what's there. Yeah. So
what else is there to know?
Yeah, they lose 13-0 sometimes. Yeah. But when I got to the bottom of the story about American Samoa and the fact that so many people put so much effort into restructuring completely restructuring the setup of a national team that was the worst in the world and had so few resources in terms of people and finances and facilities, I thought they never gave up. They genuinely didn't just say, well, of course we're the worst in the world. Look at what we've got to work with. They tried to make the best of what they had, and their victories probably meant as much to them as the victories that got, I don't know, Bosnia into a World Cup for the first time, or that won a World Cup for someone like Germany. It was the equivalent of that, and it felt like it reading it. And then you got the added extra of James getting into all sorts of scrapes. I quite liked reading about, you know, I don't know what it's like to try and fly to Palestine and then get back to Israel and back again and go to Jordan, and suddenly your passport's filled with loads of no-go zones, and you get an idea of what that's like just by reading it. There was a Dutch island that he spent time on, and you get an idea of how drugs had ravaged it. And I just thought there were so many other cultural elements to it that really kind of... And the Next Goal Wins documentary about that American Samoa team is a real tearjerker. It's brilliant.
If you had to decide one, maybe the favourite out of those three?
The Football Man, Arthur Hopcroft, I think, just because it deals with everything. So if you were trying to get to grips with why people love this game in this country, it's so rooted in that as its aim, I think, is showing that. And all the tentacles of football, how it reaches into someone's life and then dominates it, which is what it does to all of us, I think.
The best. Well, thank you very much for coming in. It's been
thanks for having me.
Pleasure having you, Dominic. What are you going to be over Christmas? Are you going to be watching games and going to games? What's that?
I'll be watching games, yeah. Obviously, there's a Boxing Day game, New Year's Eve game, so I'll be at Stamford Bridge for those two. I actually enjoy the Christmas period. I like there being a lot of football because it kind of keeps you turning over. You know, you always look to the next fixture. Most people look for the next thing to look forward to. You can look forward to the next fixture over Christmas. It's only 2 or 3 days away, so I like that.
Well, I'm very it's kind of premature to wish you Merry Christmas, but I'll do it anyway. And obviously pick up the fantastic Erbstein book for your Christmas stocking or a present for anyone. I mean, it really is a great read. And you can pick that up on Amazon.
That's right, Amazon, or at theblizzard.co.uk in the shop section.
Lovely. Well, I'll be back in a fortnight with another special guest. I'll catch you very soon. Thank you very much. Goodbye for now.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.